coming in gold and a world record. Ian Thorpe,
the birth of a legend.
458 is the total, out of which Bradman has made 309 not out. It's a world's record.
Ball in Test cricket in England for Shane Warne. And he's done it. He started off with the most beautiful delivery.
Yes! Australia have got it! Australia is back on the biggest stage.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Sam Edmund.
Everybody, and welcome to the show. As always, we're here for our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Well, today, we're in for a real treat. We're about to be joined by Australian cricket royalty, a right-handed batsman and right-arm fast-medium bowler. Shane Watson last year walked away from all forms of the game as one of the most influential white ball all-rounders of his era. A captain in all formats, Watson is a dual Alan Border medalist who also holds the record for the highest ODI score by an Australian with 185 not out. Shane Watson lived a boyhood dream and then a bit more. Shane, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you've been retired now from, well, all international cricket since 2016 and all forms of the game since only last year. How has the adjustment been after a career spanning, what, 20-odd years and after what I'm sure felt like a long journey as a kid and a teenager to even start that journey?
Yeah, look, it's been, there's no question I feel incredibly fortunate to have played for as long as I have and lived my dream for as long as I have as well, up until sort of the end of last year and the last IPL being my last tournament that I've played. And now moving on to the next phase of my life has been, I suppose I've set things up over the last couple of years and knowing that it's going to be an end point at some stage. So I'm getting into things that I love. It's a new world away from the cricket playing world. So, I'm loving sort of having more time with my family and involvement with the Players Association and also T20 Stars, the new cricket business that I've set up as well.
We'll come to life after the game shortly, but I imagine, Shane, retirement, prompts a great deal of reflection. How do you look back on your career itself? The honours, the records, they could take up this show's a lot of time if I was to read them out. So how full is the cup, so to speak?
Look, the cup is as full as it can be in regards to I gave it everything I possibly could. I know I look back with knowing that I gave it every single thing that I possibly could. I squeezed as much as I possibly could out of the talent that I have, that I had. And in the end, I suppose in anything in life, that's all you really hope to sort of know, that you've sort of done everything you possibly could to achieve as much as you can. So, and then, I look back and retirement's definitely given me time to reflect on how incredibly fortunate that I've been throughout my career, with the teams that I've played in, the opportunities that I've had as well, and the people who've sort of believed in and mentored me, and the faith that's been shown in me is, I feel crazily fortunate and lucky. Now that I've stopped playing, it sort of pinched myself in a way to think, wow, was that actually really me doing those things I was able to do?
Yeah, and you've lived this and you now look on in an official capacity with the ACA and some commentary duties to come as well. But does Australia have an unhealthy obsession, do you think, with finding an all-rounder?
I wouldn't say it's unhealthy. It's a great thing if you're an all-rounder because there's always going to be opportunities for you. And that's a beauty of, I suppose, right place, right time, being a fast bowling all-rounder when I first came onto the scene. Australian cricket, even though they had an incredible depth throughout their ranks, they were sort of this appetite for an all-rounder. So, I was right place, right time, wanting to be that person as well. It's always going to continue because being an all-rounder, it does sort of just give more options for a team, from a bowling perspective, from a batting perspective as well. So it's always going to continue because the one thing I have realised as well throughout my career, it's not that easy, especially from a physical perspective alone. There's various challenges that always come in trying to be an all-rounder, especially a fast bowling all-rounder as well. So it's not the easiest course of of your career, but certainly provides so many opportunities.
So it was more excited by the opportunity for you personally coming through rather than being suffocated by the pressure, perhaps, that balance? You were more with the former than the latter?
I knew within the team environment that I was playing in that it was just, I had more opportunities than someone if I was just predominantly a batsman, for example. Like, I had many more opportunities. There's no way that I would have played or been in around the Australian squad at the age of 20 if I was just a batsman. Or the same thing if I was just a bowler. So the opportunities that it provided, I'd fully understood the opportunities I got because of being an all-rounder. There's no question that it sort of the expectations, I allowed them to suffocate me for periods of time as well, especially when I was younger. I didn't really understand how to deal with it as well as I could. So there's no doubt that it did at times really, that expectation did sort of weigh on my shoulders pretty heavily. But deep down, I knew within the teams I was playing and, gosh, the opportunities that it provided, I wouldn't have got if I was just a specialised cricketer.
Yeah, well, that's pretty gracious of you to say. But what about social media? We know that can be a vicious space, and history is littered with sportsmen and sportswomen who have fallen down a dark spiral being consumed by that side of it. Were you in that basket? Did you find yourself keeping tabs on that and also the mainstream media as well during your career, or were you able to block it out?
Social media, I always stayed away from engaging with, as in like reading. That's one thing that I certainly just did not do whatsoever. I gradually got onto social media, but I certainly never read it because I just didn't want to sort of potentially go down a spiral digging into myself just with some of the comments that's going to be there, and the negative ones are the things that do stand out the most. But the media in general, the broader media, I suppose my way of dealing with it was just to try and not read it. That was my way of trying to just keep a equilibrium in my own mind of exactly where I was at and not allowing sort of outside influences sort of direct me in how I sort of felt about where my game was at and how I was performing and what the things I need to work on. So that was my way of sort of dealing with it, was just not to read it. There's no doubt I always found out about things a lot of the times if things happen, but I just tried to sort of stay away from it because I knew if there was some really positive articles, which were great, but one negative one would sort of really hit me really hard, and I'd really go internal. So I just stayed away from that infiltrating into my mindset.
Do you see much of yourself in Cam Green?
I'd love to have had his skill at the age that he is. With his, from his batting perspective, he really seems like he's in such control of his game. He's dominated in first class cricket as well, which means he really understands his game. He's tall, so he gets more bounces as a bowler as well. He can bowl good speed. So, I wish I had the skill that Cam Green has and capacity like he has as well to be able to bat for long periods of time. He's got the power game that we saw in the Sydney Test as well. So he's a special talent, that's for sure, which... It's so exciting to be able to see.
Yeah, have you had much to do with him, Shane, can I ask? Or are you more just watching on like the rest of us?
Yeah, it's watching from afar. Yeah, I've had nothing to do with him at all. Unfortunately, in a way, at this point in time, because I do see, well, I know exactly what he's going through, and I sort of experienced that from the age of 20, like he has, all the way through my career. And there's sort of the great things, but also the pitfalls that sort of can come in as well.
Yeah.
But no, I've just been admiring from afar, really, at this point in time.
Well, you've had plenty to keep you busy by the looks of things this year. Obviously, fatherhood with your wife, Lita, Will and Matilda. You're at the ACA, you mentioned, and you've started a business as well, haven't you? Now, tell us about T20 Stars. I had a quick look at this last night. This is a hugely admirable business you're embarking on here. For those that are unfamiliar, tell us about T20 Stars, Shane.
Yeah, so T20 Stars, there's two components to it. One is just my content and online content, and one part is my podcast, Lessons Learned with the Greats, which just interviews the greats of world cricket, sort of digging deeper into just the things that they learned throughout their career and their life about what made them so good, whether it's technically, mentally, on and off the field, that sort of thing. But then, so that's the one part is the content, but the sort of the bigger part really is the products, the cricket equipment. It's all about making high quality products, the best in the market for more affordable prices. Yeah. That's why my business model is going direct to consumer, which a lot of industries, there's disruptors who come into long standing industries And the best way and easiest way to disrupt is just to move away from the retail model and the retail margins to make sure that people are getting it at more affordable prices, which cricket for me growing up, cricket gear was always very affordable. My family grew up with not much money. Mum and Dad made the most of what they had, but cricket gear was always affordable enough to give me an opportunity to be able to do what I did. So that's what T20 Star is about, is making sure that people do get the best quality products in their hands for the prices that they should be paying.
Yeah, that's a great thing, isn't it? Making the equipment affordable, because Shane, as you would know, those of us who should have given up the dream a long, long, long time ago who are juggling family, work, and perhaps rolling the arm over and swinging the willow on the weekend, it's a balancing act with being able to afford the best equipment, which of course everyone wants to be able to do.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's across the board, whether that's entry level, just to make sure it's accessible for people who are initially just getting into cricket, because they just don't want, I love cricket so much, and it's given me the incredible life that I've had. And I want every Australian cricketer, Australian person, as much as they can, boy and girl, and throughout the world as well, to be able to have the opportunity to be able to get into cricket. It's never been an elite sport. It's never been you have to have a certain amount of money to be able to engage in the sport. So my mission is to be able to make it so it's as accessible to everyone as it was when I first really got into cricket.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life. All thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Next, we go to Ipswich, Queensland, and the start of a fantastic journey with Shane Watson.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're with former Aussie cricket star Shane Watson. Shane, you're born on June 17, 1981, to parents Bob and Barb in the Queensland town you would later be given the keys to, Ipswich. What was childhood like there?
I've only got incredible memories of growing up in Ipswich. It was very much a blue collar, hard working sort of city. And just the facilities and that were there for sport in general, especially cricket and rugby league in a way, was just the foundations were set, the pathways were set to be able to set your sights on your dreams. For me growing up, it was Alan Langer and the Walters brothers who played at the highest level in rugby league, but also Craig McDermott, who came from Ipswich and started in the same sort of teams that I was playing in, even as a young kid. So I really saw that pathway to be able to reach my dreams. So and everyone was so incredibly supportive. Just the structures, the infrastructure is in place for sport in general. It's just I feel incredibly fortunate to have sort of grown up in that area. And then with mum and dad, especially my dad being a cricket tragic and just always absolutely loved cricket. That's how I suppose I got my love of the game of cricket was through my dad. And then the support that mum and dad gave me and my sister as well to drive me to cricket games or training sessions. I certainly was always had the opportunities that were available to me because of my mum and dad. So, and again, that was because of Ipswich and the facilities that were around to allow young kids to be able to, live their dream and try and see how good they can be.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your dad, Bob, and his love for the game, because he would end up spending a fair bit of time behind the wheel, wouldn't he? A few times a week getting into East Redlands in Brisbane for cricket, obviously, as you progressed through the ranks and through the age group.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a big commitment from dad, especially at the age of 16. I was working through which clubs to play in four in Brisbane, and East Redlands were really the one that the most opportunities were there. Also, one of my really good mates at that time, or still his, Dane McKenzie, was playing there as well. So it was a way to be able to get the best opportunity. So Dad would drive me to training. It's like an hour each way every Wednesday evening. And then drive me to games as well before I had my license. So it's a big commitment. But again, that's just what mum and dad did for me. because they just wanted to give their, you know, the kids, my sister and I, every opportunity that was available. So, and it was a great thing that Dad loved his cricket too, so it was easy. He just loved going there, sitting around watching cricket, whether it's the training or in the games as well. So, and that's where, I suppose, when things progressed to where they did, it was like his dream. He's now sit there and his excuse to be able to watch test matches and watch cricket for a long period of time with not having to worry about mum sort of chipping away at him by just being at the cricket all the time.
Yeah, the chore list can wait, can't it, Bub? I love it. And I wanted to tap into, if I can, Shane, your desire. I mean, every kid who plays cricket sort of has that dream they want to play for Australia. But for you, how real was that? Was it something that drove you even at this age? I just wanted to tap into what really motivated you to progress.
Yeah, I always absolutely loved cricket. It was always my number one. It's also a sport that I was the best at as well, I suppose, more naturally, because I played a lot of different sports growing up, whether it was I played rugby league and in primary school and rugby union in high school, played different sports like tennis and everything really I could because I just loved sports in general. But I always just had that deep down desire. I remember as a young kid, I think I was like 7 or 8, I said to my mum, watching a test match, that's what I want to do. I want to play cricket for Australia. Mm. And as your mum does, like, oh, that's great. It's great that you've got dreams. You've got to work hard. But it got to the stage of, like, as a 16-year-old, of course, my studies were as important as my cricket, because it's something that mum and dad always instilled in me. But I put all other sports aside and just focused on cricket. And in the end, what my mindset was, I just want to be the best cricketer I can be, whatever that is. If that's the best second grade cricketer I can be, or first grade cricketer, or my dream, of course, was to play for Australia, I just wanted to leave no stone unturned whatsoever to be able to see how good I could be. And I was just very fortunate that opportunities, I was right place, right time with certain things that allowed my trajectory to continue pretty quickly, really, from Queensland under-19s through to Aussie under-19s. And at that time, the Holy Grail was going to the cricket academy that Rod Marsh was in charge of, because that was the sort of breeding ground of all Australia's, just about all of Australia's best cricketers that had been through since the early 90s. So that was like the Holy Grail to get to, because if you got there, then took in everything that was there, then that was work for everyone else, so why couldn't it work for me?
Yeah,
and that was just fortunate I got that opportunity as well.
Yeah, apologies. I was going to ask about the Australian Cricket Academy. So you were joined as a scholarship holder in 2000, obviously, as a teenager. Mm. What other names were in and around the mix there when you got there?
Yeah, so Mitchell Johnson was there, Nathan Horrett, Chris Hartley, Andrew McDonald, Adam Bogis, Phil Jakes. Trying to think. I'm probably missing a couple, but it was a great intake year in a way, which, a lot of those guys were on the play for Australia, and if not, had a really long domestic first class career as well. So, but that was one of the last years that Rod Marsh took that full time cricket academy that were there for 4.5 months. Like, just the best. Like, what dreams are made of, just to eat, sleep, breathe cricket for, like, the highest quality and calibre for 4.5 months is just, like, a dream come true.
You formed a real friendship with Mitch Johnson, and in his book, he lifted the lid on some music antics. I'm sure you've been asked this over the journey, but wrestling was a big part of life there, it seems, at the academy.
It was, and there's one event that I didn't realise. I didn't think it happened, because Mitch is much stronger than me. He's always doing the wrestlers anyway, so if anything was going to happen, he was the one who was going to dominate me, because he's much stronger than me, much more powerful, as you can see with the speed that he bowled. But we had a lot of fun, and they were just like, everyone sort of, in a way, people's dreams and stars are in their eyes about what potentially could lie ahead, and it was just everyone was just pushing themselves to the limits to see how good they could be.
I think the bit, though, that we most of us like, Shane, was that the wrestling only took place during the ad breaks on Neighbours. Not during, just in the
ad
break.
Right. Exactly, that's right. Yeah, it was all on for young and old in the breaks. We at that time, we were very much obsessed with Neighbours, that's for sure.
Getting a spot in the Queensland lineup around this time, I mean, biding your time was a thing, and people waited back then to break in, or at least that was the expectation. But you chose a different path, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, which didn't go down too well with the true blue sort of old school Queenslanders in a way. But I suppose my dream was always to play for Australia, and the steps to get there, of course, was to be able to play first class cricket as a starting point. And the guys that I went to the academy with, there wasn't too many people who had the opportunity to be able to play first class cricket. So that for me, I got an opportunity from Greg Shifford, who was the coach of Tasmania at that time. He took a big risk on me to offer me, really, to come down to Tassie halfway through the season, play the last five Shield games and last five One Day games, and with no guarantees that I was going to get a contract or anything like that, but it's more so, let's see what you can do. So it was a big risk for Greg Shipard to take, and I just saw it as an amazing opportunity to be able to just get fast track in front of all the guys that I went to the academy with, just about. So for me, it was a no-brainer. The Queensland guys it wasn't done. Like, everyone, younger cricketer coming through, you mainly sort of, if you're really, really good, you'd make your debut at the age of like 23-24 if you're lucky, because it was a very well-established team that had dominated Australian cricket for a long period of time at that stage. So there was no real opportunity. It was, for me, an easy decision, but it didn't go down too well with the captain, Stuart Law, who had been very kind and spent some time with me in the lead-up to me sort of leaving, and Jimmy Ma, who did take me under his wing because I played at his club, East Redlands, as well. So, it sort of rubbed them up the wrong way a little bit, which they didn't really like, and made it very known that they weren't that happy. But in the end, it was an opportunity that is too hard to refuse.
Yeah, fair enough. You're with This Is Your Sporting Life, brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Just visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Well, Shane Watson's eventful Shield debut for Tasmania and his elevation to the international cricket stage are up next.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Sporting Life. We're chatting with former powerhouse Australian all-rounder Shane Watson. Shane, sledging betrayal genius. Shane Watson's Shield debut. That was the title of the piece by Adam Burnett that appeared on cricket.com.au at the start of the year, which detailed your first game for Tasmania at Shield level. And as you just touched on before the break, that simmering anger held by, well, I guess you'd describe them as the old bulls at the time, Stuart Law and Jimmy Ma, which I think you might have also detailed in your book, Watto. Compelling article, which I assume you've read.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I read it. It was incredible research that Adam Burnett did to be able to put that and piece that all together and talk to the people that he did. So, to be able to relive that through that article as well was beautifully well written. It's interesting to sort of see it in that light again. But yeah, look, there's no doubt it was a baptism of fire, and I always knew, like, going down, that it was going to be that way. But I in the end, I wouldn't have wanted my debut any other way, because it wasn't really going to get much tougher than that, to be honest with you. If I could absorb that hostility that was there as I walked out to bat, and through that game, then I was going to be able to absorb most things that were sort of thrown away on the cricket field. So it made me sort of really sink or swim at that stage. And I suppose I just had that deep down determination of what I wanted to do and how and where I wanted to get to, in a way. And I just, so determined to just allow everything sort of to bounce off me.
Just to paint the picture, Shane, around that hostility back in the day down in Hobart, you come to the crease on debut, mind you, with Tassie at, I think, 5 for 67, Queensland bowling first on a green-seeming wicket. Now, I don't think there were too many teenagers playing Shield level at that stage. Now, you're not out in both digs despite a heavy defeat and all manner of sledging and the like coming your way. You must have taken some satisfaction from that.
Oh, yeah, of course. And I suppose the biggest satisfaction was that that I had the game to be able to deal with the quality of opposition I was playing against. I was facing Michael Kasperwitz, who was, one of the leading bowlers in Australia, Joe Dawes, who had an incredible incredible record as well, Adam Dale, who was at the peak of his powers, just about at that stage as well. So, like, for me, it was more so the satisfaction that I've got the game, the skill at that stage, even as a 19 or 20-year-old, 19-year-old, to be able to negate what they're throwing at me. So that was the most satisfying part, more so than anything. And again, again, it sort of just confirmed the decision that I've made to move down to Tasmania to be able to sort of make the most of that incredible opportunity that Greg Shibbett had given me to be able to test my skills out and see what I could do.
And just as an extension from that match, I guess coming to grips with the game at this level in your late teens, early 20s, the mental test, the need for a tough exterior, well, and interior, it might have mellowed a bit in recent times, but how hot was the kitchen back then if you were a shrinking violet?
It's hot. there's no question. Back then as well, those things were a little bit looser around what was allowed. There was no stunt mics. There's nothing on TV at that stage as well. So that's what sort of toughened you up. And again, it's either sink or swim. You either got swallowed up by it, or you had techniques to allow it to bounce off you and just sort of get into the mindset that you needed to try and bring out your skill that you had. So I wouldn't have it any other way. It was a great exposure of what potentially, and in the end, like looking back on it, on the field, the things didn't probably get as bad, like anywhere near as bad as that throughout my career. But off the field, yeah, certainly there was more challenges that I had to develop the skills around how to navigate those.
You make your ODI debut against South Africa in 2002 over there. So your first overseas tour. What sort of welcome did a young buck get back then? One who may be seen in some quarters as not having, was yet to pay his dues and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I suppose I was very fortunate to be able to go on the test tour, which was the first part of that South African tour, to bring me in. I was like the 15th person on that tour, just sort of get me around into that environment, Aussie environment. I was never ever going to play a test match, but that was sort of a way to be able to just find my feet in that environment. And there was a couple of people who it took a couple of weeks at least to be able to, for them to sort of just accept me into the group in a way, because I hadn't paid my dues. I was only played really a year and a half of a first class cricket at that stage, but apart from one or two people, which I fully understood, because a lot of those guys paid their dues and some to get into that team, everyone else was incredibly like welcoming with open arms. Shane Warne, Steve Waugh, Ricky Ponting, Brett Lee, those guys in particular were just like were incredible to me. Just the way they allowed me in, just looked after me, allowed me to ask and pepper them with so many different questions about so many different parts of not just cricket but life as well. Lifelong friendships that developed from there, which are again my heroes that I was able to get to know from a cricket perspective and then personally as things went on.
And hey, look, at the very least, touring with Shane Warne would have been fun.
Yeah, you certainly knew how to have a good time on and off the field. And that's the beauty of Warnie. And the beauty of Warnie is just how incredibly loyal he is to his mates as well, and how much he looks after them and supports them and guides them and mentors them. And I've been so fortunate throughout my career. If it wasn't for him, the opportunities that I got and the learnings that I had through county cricket, but then also onto the IPL with Warnie captaining Rajasthan and getting me there as well. Oh, gosh, he was instrumental. So two people in particular who were really instrumental in my career, and if it wasn't for them, certainly wouldn't have been able to achieve the things that I had. One was Shane Warne and the other one, Ricky Ponting.
Yeah.
With his leadership, his mateship, his mentorship as well. It's just without Ricky, I certainly never would have achieved and the faith that he had in me, I never would have achieved the things I did. And the same goes with Shane Warne.
I was going to ask you about Ricky, Shane. I mean, he was your idol growing up, and you did make your testable, I think, 3 years later against Pakistan, might have been at the SCG, and the names just jump off the page. Langer, Hayden, McGrath, Warne, Martin, Gillespie, the list goes on and on. But I wanted to ask you about Ricky because he was your idol growing up. You're able to spend some time with him, rooming with him. I mean, that must have been incredible for you.
Yeah, it certainly was. He was, from the time that he came onto the international scene in 94-95, he made his debut against Sri Lanka in Perth. He was just the way he played game I just absolutely loved from a batting point of view, and then in the field the impact that he had was mesmerising, really. So he was someone that I just aspired to to be, and he was my idol. So to be able to have the opportunity by being down in Tasmania, even before I got in and around the Aussie team, he took me under his wing. He played a couple of Shield games for Tasmania, my first uh, well my first full year of Shield cricket, and he was just incredibly good to me from the outset. And then to be able to go on and play with him lead me as captain and guide me, and the patience that he showed, especially through my injuries that I had, and as I developed my skills. And then some of the most enjoyable times that I've ever had on the cricket field was batting with Ricky, and some of the partnerships that we had to be able to do that with your hero growing up was I never took it for granted. I cherished every moment.
We're talking to Australian cricket superstar Shane Watson on This Is Your Sporting Life, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Injuries, DRS and more right after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, it's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Sporting Life, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Shane Watson is our special guest today. Shane, before you conquered international cricket, I think it's fair to say you had to conquer your injury problems. The list goes on here. Back stress fractures, hamstring strains, calf problems, hip complaints, a dislocated shoulder. And yours was a brittle body at this stage. I mean, how deep was the level of frustration for you, or if not panic, that you knew you could compete at the highest level, but it could be taken away from you by forces outside your control?
Oh yeah, it was incredibly frustrating, especially when I knew that my skills were developing and getting to a stage where I could compete against the best cricketers in the world, but then my body just wasn't allowing me to do it. So and I just would try different things and different techniques to be able to try and alleviate my injuries and reduce the chance of that happening. But yeah, I suppose the asset that I had as a young guy was how strong I was, because I was just obsessed of being getting the best out of my body, of being a fast bowler and bowling as fast as I could. So I very much was in the gym and getting bigger and stronger, which was a huge asset in my early 20s for sure, that I could strength-wise, I could compete with the best cricketers in the world. But then that sort of led to other like injuries, especially the soft tissue injuries and that as well, which just was ongoing, is trying to pull back those issues that I and reverse those issues that I had because of my strength training especially. So it wasn't until that I became desperate after 2007, the first T20 World Cup in South Africa, after I sort of strained my hamstring again, I was desperate. I was either going to have to stop bowling altogether, because that was the main thing that was sort of getting me injured, or just do something very different and radical, which I did. I was able to find a guru who's based in Brisbane, who'd been with the Brisbane Lions through their sort of glory days and the glory years through the early 2000s. And he sort of helped educate me and rebuild my body, really. And it took about 18 months to rebuild my body. And then it got to a stage where I was much more resilient. I still had a few little hiccups here and there, but it certainly was much, much more resilient. That was when, also because I felt like, because my injuries, like I was never going to see how good I could be on the international stage, that my injury sort of resilient or body resilient coincided with my freedom that I had in my mind to be able to go out and just enjoy the pleasure I had of doing what I dreamed as a kid. And that freedom sort of just came into the game. And then I got lucky that the opportunity came along to open the batting in 2009 in the Ashes series, the third test in Edgbaston, and I had the freedom in the mind at that stage as well. So things just sort of went from there, which are right place, right time with my mindset and the skill set at that stage, and I could make the most of it.
The physio you speak of, that was Viktor Popov, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. He's a genius. Yeah. Just how he understands the human body and the different ways as a sort of holistic being, how to be able to sort of get the best out of it and re-engineer it at certain times, which he had to do with me. Gosh, it wasn't him, I would have been a batsman through and through from 2007 onwards.
Yeah, but you broke the mould though with that, didn't you? Because you invested in him, I think, full time. He was by your side all the time, which, in a setup like the Australian cricket team, all those staff are already on board, of course. So did you rub a few people up the wrong way with that? And secondary to that, such was the desperation, did you even care at the time?
Good questions, both of those. One, I did rub some people up the wrong way. Ricky was incredible about it. So I had Ricky's support. So I knew that I was protected, and he was just going to make sure that the noise that was going on, that he'd just not let that come in whatsoever. So if it wasn't for Ricky's support, then it just wouldn't have worked. But because of him, it certainly did. But it certainly rubbed people up the wrong way. But because I was so desperate, I didn't care. I managed it as well as I possibly could. And again, Ricky really helped me try and manage that as well as I could. But I was so desperate to go, you know what, I want to see how good I can be. And that was investing in myself, as it was at that time a significant investment into my body. And that was, that was a year or two into sort of Lee and I, my wife, sort of wasn't my wife that stage, but together. And it was a joint decision to, you know, I have to invest in this. I have to invest in myself, see how good I can be, because I'd hate to sort of look back and know that I didn't give it everything I could to see whether I could be the all-rounder, whether my body could actually support what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was the best investment that I ever made, to be able to have him full-time. He was full-time with me on tour for 12 months. It was an incredible time to have that person with me. And it was not just physically working with me, it was also mentally sort of working through how to navigate, you know, the different physical and body challenges as well, which was very right place, right time.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned your power and your size. You went from weights to Pilates. You got off the alcohol completely. You started meditating, yoga. And look, you mentioned the opening chance to open the batting for a period of time. You really reaped the rewards. I wanted to ask you about three letters DRS. So how would you describe your relationship with DRS over the course of your career, Shane?
Naive. that's just probably as simple as it is. I was very naive around how to use it, because growing up, you're always just, yeah, you got to accept the umpire's decision. So that's how it always was. And then it came to, was that like 27, 28, a long way into my career, that all of a sudden you've got a chance to be able to question the umpires. And I didn't sit down and sort of do my math well enough about the probabilities of things getting overturned or not. It was more so gut feel, and my gut feel was, of course, I didn't want to get out. I hated getting out. So my gut feel was always skewed towards one way. But so if I had my time again, that would probably be the time where I did go onto social media and get the sort of read the room a little bit more to understand what people were saying, just to stop it. I went a little bit too far of still trying to use it, still feeling like I could use it well. And I should have just read the room earlier and just stopped. And it would have saved me a lot of, sledging and on and off the field.
I should add, though, it's not like we've really improved in this space, it must be said, but I'm sure you'd be jack of this too, Shane, but if you could indulge us for a second here, can you recount the story involving Chris Rogers? I think the Ashes of 2013, if you'd be so kind.
Chris Rogers is, gosh, he's one of the most enjoyable, like, he's one of the best teammates I've ever played with. He's a genuinely good person. And I just loved batting with him because he just had so much control over his game. It was just super impressive to be able to bat with. But yeah, this is a time at Lord, another sort of LBW shout. And as you do, you sort of walk up to your mate and say, what do you think? I said, oh, don't worry, it felt like it's out. And he's like, no, I think it might have hit you outside the line, or it might have been down leg, whichever one it was. Because I think you should review it. And that was probably the tip. That was probably the icing on the cake. that one. I think after that, I'm pretty sure I reined it in, because that was sort of like the tip of the iceberg, where I just got absolutely heckled from all parts, really. So, but that's again, you're going with your gut feel. So that's all part of learning this new technology, how to use it, and gut feel with that technology. No, it doesn't work.
Oh, you poor bugger. Just a small one on this one. It became known as Homework Gate. Obviously, it occurred around that sort of time as well, when obviously yourself and Mitch Johnson, Usman Khawaja and James Pattinson were sent home, if you like, for failing to complete a task that centred around how the team and individuals could improve. We know all that. Mark Waugh said he'd never heard of anything so stupid in his life. I mean, how has that small chapter in your career lived on with you, Shane, if at all?
Oh, now it doesn't. Hasn't lived on with me now at all. For a couple of years, it certainly did. There were some scars for me personally, but also for those other three guys who were involved as well. But like in the end, like every sort of thing that pops up in life, and especially the challenges and the negative sort of things that happen to you, it's one of it is the time when you learn the most, and you have to be able to work through next time if a situation like that arose, whether it's as a coach in the future or you know, as a player and educating and guiding people who are coming through a team environment as well. It's just it was a great learning experience. But yeah, it certainly was a difficult time. To know that you'd done something. And growing up, you always knew if you did something inappropriate, that what could lead to being suspended from a test match. But that certainly wasn't one of the things that was on my list at that stage. And it wasn't on just about everyone's list. But again, it's just one of those things that if I had that time again, there's a couple of things that I probably politically would have done a little bit differently. But in the end, I was just standing true to what I believed in and what I'd been educated on, how to an environment, sort of a successful environment, worked and grew, because that's always my education coming through as a 20-year-old within one of my successful eras in Australian cricket. So I just always stayed true to that. But politically, I probably would have just been a little bit more, play things a little bit differently to not get caught up in the crossfire.
Yeah, and it probably should be noted that the coach at the time, Mickey Arthur, I think in the years since, has expressed some regret over it all as well. Hey, Shane, we referenced the 185 not out earlier, the highest ODI score by an Australian. It was against Bangladesh in 2011 off 96 balls. I mean, you had many matches where you found yourself, quote unquote, in the zone. I just wanted to ask you what that felt like when you're really humming, when you're seeing them like a beach ball. What does that feel like as a professional batsman, athlete, to just be at the peak of your powers out there in the middle?
Oh, that's what you're always chasing. And that's just not as an athlete. That's as in everything, that every walk of life. You're always trying to find that space where you can get to where it's just, it's effortless in a way, and you just wish you could turn that on every time you go out, every time you need to perform in whatever you do. And that was just a situation where it was more so the circumstances came together. Like, we bowled first, it was very hot in Bangladesh, sort of I was opening the batting, and in the end I was too cooked, it was too hot to run. So in the end I just took it on and kept taking it on because I couldn't, it was just too hot. To be able to run. So I suppose I just kept going at it.
There he goes for the big one again. It's going all the way for maximum into the stands. Goodness gracious, that is a splendid strike.
And it was just one of those days where, the bowlers, the matchups, the wickets, the wicket at the time as well. It was a beautiful wicket to bat on. And it just sort of came together. And before I knew it, we'd won the game fairly quickly.
He's not quite finished. Another one. Oh, this is bigger than anything that you can see. Smile, Watson.
Well, this is absolutely fantastic from Watson. This one was massive, bigger than the other one. Six number 13. This is unbelievable stuff. This is one-of-a-kind innings, one-of-a-kind knock from Watson. It's been a pure pleasure watching him.
A couple of quick ones before we let you go. Fastest bowler you faced?
Fastest bowler I'd faced was Shoaib Akhtar in a one-day game that we played as a winter series that we played. It was actually at the Gabba, this game. Shoaib Akhtar got five for not many. The ball was reversing very early, about the 13th or 14th over, and it was my 21st birthday. It was crazy fast. Like 157, 158. It was the first time I'd sort of faced it to that extent, that speed. So I remember that innings very clearly, because that was, hardly saw the ball, and my reflexes fully hadn't developed at that stage as well. So,
unbelievable.
So that was a big test, yeah.
Unbelievable. Most treasured, we'll start with individual, we'll do team as well, but most individual moment in cricket, what's your most treasured?
Oh my gosh. Individual. it's hard to it's hard to give one in particular, because there's been so many that I feel so fortunate to have achieved throughout my career. For Australia individually, there's probably three innings, and one is my high score at the Oval in an Ashes Test 2013. To be able to bat like that after sort of the issues that I had, especially the LBW issues that I had in the lead up to that, throughout that series. The 161 the MCG in a one-day game against England, that was probably after having us losing that Ashes series in 2010-11, to be able to then bat like that in the first sort of one-day game against England at the MCG was very, very special. And probably from a 2020 perspective for Australia was my high score against India at, like, in 2016 after, you know, I'd been sort of dropped from Test cricket and one-day cricket to know that I still had that that skill inside of me was very memorable.
Well, I did put you on the spot there, and the reflexes are as sharp off the pitch as they were on. Shane Watson, been an absolute pleasure to talk today. What a heck of a journey it's been, and what a resume you have to now show for it. I mean, you had an immense talent from a young age, that was clear, but your conviction and your unrelenting determination made you a champion, and you were never scared to do things your way. The setbacks you encountered with your body would have seen many chuck it in. Well done on all you achieved. Best of luck with what's to come as well. T20stars.com is the website for your latest venture. It looks magnificent and such a worthy pursuit. Thanks a lot for joining us on Sporting Life.
Oh, you're incredibly kind. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us also. You've been listening to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Jump online. You can find them at tobinbrothers.com.au. And we'll catch you the next week to celebrate the life of another sporting icon.